from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour, each year, charities such as Florida-based Kids Wish Network raise millions of dollars. But according to a joint investigation by the Center for Investigative Reporting, the Tampa Bay Times, and CNN, Kids Wish Network gave less than 3 cents on the dollar to the cause. The investigation identifies the nation's 50 worst charities, all of which devoted less than 4% of donations to direct cash aid. We'll discuss the investigation, what should be done to crack down on bad charities, and how to make good decisions about where to send your charitable dollars. Forum is next, right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. A joint investigation was conducted by the Center for Investigative Reporting, the Tampa Bay Times, and CNN, which highlighted fraud, abuse, and waste in a number of U.S. charities, pinpointing what they ultimately characterized as the 50 worst charities in the country. There are, of course, many high-minded, noble charities which conduct themselves with integrity, but a significant number are providing a large percentage of what is donated to pay for telemarketers and fundraising operations, rather than the recipients they are claiming to be working on behalf of, being the beneficiaries. This opening hour, we want to discuss the findings of this investigation, and we want to look at ways that you can find out what an organization or organizations you donate your money to may or may not be doing with your money. Joining us for the hour here in studio is Kendall Taggart, a data reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting. Welcome. Good morning.
Good morning.
We also have Alexander Berger with us, senior research analyst with GiveWell, San Francisco-based charity evaluator. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And with us by phone from St. Petersburg is Chris Hundley, and she's part of the investigative team, works with the Tampa Bay Times as an investigative reporter. Welcome, Chris Hundley.
Thank you.
I also want to welcome Doug White, who teaches board governance and fundraising and ethics at Columbia University. He's also an advisor to nonprofit organizations and philanthropists and is the author of The Nonprofit Challenge, Integrating Ethics into the Purpose and Promise of Our Nation's Charities. Welcome, Doug White.
And hello to you.
Hello. We welcome you all to the program. Let me begin with Kendall Taggart here in studio. First of all, I want to put out kudos to you and to Chris Hundley for just slogging through literally tens of thousands of public record pages in 36 states. I mean, I know this was a pretty formidable enterprise, to put it mildly. But to narrow this down to 50, we're talking about pretty egregious cases, are we not?
We are. Chris and I ultimately looked at, from about 1.6 million tax-exempt organizations, winnowed it down to 6,000 that are using outside fundraisers, telemarketers, or other kinds of fundraisers. And then the 50 worst are the ones who consistently, year after year, for a decade, have been giving 70, 80, 90% of the money raised in their name to an outside company and very little to the cause.
Some of this is so egregious. I mean, I saw the CNN report by Anderson Cooper, and he's saying these people should be on T-shirts or they should be have their pictures posted on trees. He said just about everything other than they should have been a wanted poster. But we're talking about, let's talk about a couple of these organizations. Let's name them. There's they use names very similar to organizations that are well-known, like one of them is the Cancer Fund, and another of them, that Florida-based one, Kids Wish Network, as opposed to Make-A-Wish, which doesn't use any telemarketers and never has. So it's difficult for people who are asked out of the kindness of their heart to give money to distinguish sometimes who they're getting solicited by.
Certainly. Kids Wish Foundation, which was the number one on our list, operates out of a metal warehouse in Holiday, Florida. And they originally were called Fulfill-A-Wish. Make-A-Wish Foundation sued them several years ago because of the similarities in their name. So it's certainly a problem that well-respected nonprofits face, is having other groups with very similar sounding causes get donations from the public who's unaware of the difference.
And we're talking about, like in this example, the Cancer Fund, people with extraordinary salaries of the same family. You try to get to them with a camera. I think this was also CNN, and a young guy who has a high salary, who's the son, gave them the bird. I mean, you know, they won't talk to anybody on camera, a lot of these organizations. That's a perfect example of what.
Certainly. Many of the organizations we were looking at would either only speak with us through an attorney, never returned our calls, or sent vague emails that really didn't help us understand what their programs were.
And the fact of the matter is, Chris Hundley, that we're talking about organizations that I know you wanted to look at the whole industry, but there are a lot of bad apples in that industry. And some are bogus immediately after a tragedy. They kind of set up a tent and say, you know, we're helping people with Sandy or we're helping people in Newtown, and they're not helping anybody but themselves for the most part.
You're exactly right. We have heard since the story ran from people who were involved in those kind of tragedies you just referred to, who have set up a national compassion fund that hopes to step in and be able to make sure that money raised goes to victims and doesn't get allocated to other uses. But our project really looked at charities on a historical basis. What have they done over the past decade? Because you often hear that charities say they have to use these kind of outside fundraisers when they first get started to build up a donor list and to build up support in the community. What we found was these charities never build up a donor list. They continue to rely often for decades on these outside fundraisers who take 70, 80, 90 cents of every dollar.
And you only have 12 states to begin with databases. Why is it so easy to get this nonprofit status? I mean, to some extent, I know it's state by state, but shouldn't the IRS be looking into this? They're looking into Tea Party and all those organizations.
The IRS does indeed give tax-exempt status to everyone nationwide. The 12 states you refer to with the databases, that was kind of a second prong that we took in this research. One was looking at fundraising expenses. The other thing we looked at was if you get in trouble in one state, if you get banned from a state because of your soliciting practices, there's nothing really to stop you from moving to another state using the same name or setting up under a new name and going back to work. So we gathered disciplinary data from every state. We found that only 12 states even keep a comprehensive database of the actions they've taken against charities. Other states said, you just have to look at our press releases. So we've put together a database of 8,000 actions that have been taken over the past decade by state regulators. You can look up the name of the charity. You can look up the name of the fundraiser. You can look up an individual's name to see if there has ever been any disciplinary action against that entity. And that's now available on our website.
And you want to give out that website?
It's www.tampabay.com/charity.
And are we really talking about the worst charities, or would it be more accurate to say these are 50 charity scams, or, you know, you've been critiqued by the Association of Fundraisers that these are outliers?
I think it's important to remember that as outliers, these 50 charities alone over the past decade raised $1.35 billion. The fundraisers kept $1 billion. And that we're just talking 50 charities that we caught in this screening process. So they may be outliers, but there's a lot of money at stake here.
And there's also a lot of outright lying. I mean, they'll call people and they'll say 100% of this goes without any other money to anything else, and they're lying through their teeth.
Certainly. We definitely found that some of the telemarketers, when asked by potential donors how much money was going to go to the charity directly, they'd say 100%, and the reality was more like 80%. I think that also raises a good question. While these are certainly bad apples within the industry, they're the ones that were relatively honest in the data that they reported. Otherwise, we wouldn't have found them to begin with.
Well, in California, we found one in Fremont, for example. Let's just talk about that for a moment, because there was a UCSF professor and a pediatrician on the board. They didn't really even know what was going on with this charity for the most part. So they put them on the board somehow, or sounded like a good cause, and they signed up to be on the board.
Certainly. This was a woman named Janet Elon Greenhall, who was a Canadian woman, and she got in trouble in Canada in 1999 for high fundraising costs. Her charity was ultimately shut down, but within a year of getting in trouble, she had
Forgive
founded,
me, we should say this was a charity for childhood diseases specifically.
Sure, yeah. It's actually called Optimal Medical Foundation, but they fundraise under the name Childhood Disease Research Foundation. And in a year after she got in trouble in Canada, they had started a new organization listed with an address in California. When I went to visit the organization, it was actually at a pediatrician's house in Fremont. He said the board hadn't met in 5 years. I went to another board member's house. He had no idea he was on the board, that his name had been used in IRS filings or filings with the California Attorney General. And that's the former UCSF professor you're referring to.
And they raised $8 million for grants by direct mail and telemarketing. And what, about $10,000 was spent on those who were in need or those who they were supposedly helping?
Well, their biggest research grant that they gave out is about $10,000. It was given to the president of the charity's own for-profit company, where she's vice president.
To make a movie.
Right, of course.
What about, let's bring Doug White into this. Doug White, what about the argument that a lot of fundraisers really have to do what they do in the profit sector? In other words, there's a kind of double standard about nonprofit versus profit sector, and they have to market, they have to. I'm not talking about these outliers or these scam operations or fraudulent operations. I'm just talking about in general.
Well, I don't think there's a double standard. I think that a lot of organizations do have to act like businesses, and they do have to market, and they have to get their name out, and they have to find people who are aligned with their cause. The difference is that a charity is selling something that's not tangible. It's selling its mission, and the reason it's in business is to help society in a way that neither government nor business does. So the charity has to keep that in mind, and the organizations that we're hearing about right now from both Kendall and Chris are organizations that have no sense of what I call a charitable ethos, because while there is importance put to an organization having to be businesslike, that becomes a less important question as the business grows. The organization itself has to understand that it's doing something that business is not. And one of those things, unlike a business, is that it is helping society. It is helping people who otherwise wouldn't get that help. And what Chris and Kendall have uncovered are organizations that have no sense of this sense of purpose, and what they're trying to do is raise money for themselves. And so, in my view, even though the IRS hasn't shut them down, I think they should, but that's another issue, and each state hasn't shut them down, and I think it should, but as I say, that's another issue.
Although, excuse me, each state has different form of regulation.
The state regulation is a mess. It's a chaotic mess. Even here in New York, where I think the regulation is probably more sophisticated than it is in other states, although you do have places like California and Florida and a few others that really make, I think, an honest effort at trying to put this together. It is a chaotic mess.
But it seems like if you fill out a 990, you're in.
You mentioned this earlier. One statistic your listeners should know is that of the applications that the IRS gets for charitable status each year, they approve 98.5%.
Well, you know, you kind of throw your hands up and say, what can be done then in wake of that and the fact that there's such chaos in terms of the state regulation? Plus, there's also a kind of public awareness here of what I've described as a double standard without being aware of it. You talk about the ethos of charity. There are a lot of people who say, well, does 100% go to this, what it's supposed to go to? What about the CEO? What is the CEO making? And suddenly they devoid themselves from what might be a good and respectable charity because they think the charity shouldn't act like the profit segment at all. There's a different ethos that's applied to the charity.
Well, it is, and I think that's one of the reasons there are charitable organizations. I mean, if there weren't that difference, then there wouldn't be a need for charities. You just have a bunch of businesses. So, you know, there is something that, and I will accept this responsibility as kind of a spokesperson for this moment anyway, on the charitable side of things, even though I think we need to dig deeper. My love for charities involves critiquing the bad apples because charity, too many people borrow the good name of charity to do their dirty deeds. So my view is that we need to do a lot more toward what the kind of work that Kendall and Chris have done. And the public itself, there's really, the government's not going to get into it. The IRS, as you can see in today's headlines, at least in the last several weeks, the IRS is having a lot of difficulty, even with its it's in another category.
Senator Cruz has called for the abolition of the IRS, by the way. Ted Cruz, yes, officially.
I think I've heard that before. But you know, we need to do more. And I think the impetus for doing more is going to come from places like the investigative reporting that Chris and Kendall have done and the kind of programs that KQED and other organizations are doing. It's going to come from the media. I don't think it's going to come from the government.
Well, that's why I'm glad we're doing this program, and I'm appreciative of all of your being here. I want to get some tips from you, though, Doug White, about what people can do. I mean, should they just, as a general rule, not trust any kind of telemarketer, or do they have to do research on their own and look? I mean, there are a lot of available sites, for example. We'll give them out, like Charity Navigator and GiveWell. We're going to talk to Alexander Berger from GiveWell that give you this information, GuideStar. But, you know, a lot of people just, they'll get a phone call and they'll think, oh, this is a good option for me. I don't have the time. I'll just give them money and 10, 20 bucks, and that adds up. They get a lot of money as a result.
This is where the blood boils, because these organizations that have been identified, and there are many others, these are just the 50 worst, this is where the blood boils. These people are taking advantage of emotions and heartstrings, and they're doing so under illegal auspices. And that's just wrong. It's just there's no qualification to it. That's just wrong. So what can people do? I would never, I hate to say this, because there are organizations that are not in the 50 worst, or even bad organizations that have to use telemarketers, but I would never give to a telemarketer, ever. That should be a 100% rule without qualification. If the charity's good, it will have a website. If the charity's good, it will welcome phone calls on its own. If the charity's good, it will send you information. If the charity's good, it will invite you to its organization to meet the people. This business of having a paid solicitor simply take, you know, the heartstring of someone and then of a donation take 70, 80, 90 percentage points of whatever is promised is it's so wrong. I can't.
No, I'm with you. It makes my blood boil, too, because there are so many flim-flammers out there and there's so much abuse and playing on people's heartstrings. But there are other guidelines. I mean, if people will just go to the effort, the media has a responsibility here. I agree with you. It's one of the reasons why we're doing this program, and we're fortunate to have people like Chris and Kendall with us. But the fact of the matter is people have to take a little bit of responsibility and maybe, you know, go to these websites that will help them. And I think you have a rule of thumb, don't you, that no more than 3.5% of fundraising should go to other than where it's supposed to go?
Yes, I was talking about that yesterday, and this comes up a lot. 35% is the...
I'm sorry, 35, yeah.
Which is to say 65%. That's what the Better Business Bureau recommends. That's just a very loose rule. There are organizations that some years will not fit into that because of legitimate reasons. I actually talked to the the public TV station in Tampa Bay a few years ago. They had a zero-star rating from Charity Navigator, but that was because they had to go and buy a lot of new equipment. I'm sure KQED had to at the time. And so the numbers were out of sync for the what would be considered a normal ratio. But, yes, you're absolutely correct. People have, and because of GuideStar, people have such an ability, an easy ability, to find out all of these numbers. And Charity Navigator and GiveWell and others are compiling this data. Now, that's not the end-all in terms of evaluating a charity. Let me be very clear. I'm very strong about that not being the only way to evaluate a charity through its 990 information. But I agree with you. The person who's being solicited or the general public should also be seeing itself to go to the website and check out this information.
There are also a lot of hidden expenses. Maybe we can talk about that with you, Alexander Berger. I mean, there are people who establish themselves as nonprofits, and then they say, I just heard recently about a private school head who said, I need a new kitchen in the house because I entertain people, and it'll allow me to have more money. I need to also have a special seat at the ballpark and all these kinds of things. And these are expenses that can run wild.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can see executive compensation sort of go crazy, but I actually think that that's really the anomaly rather than the rule. You know, Chris mentioned that, you know, $1.35 billion has gone to these 50 charities that they identified over the past decade. You know, we're talking like less than half a percent, I mean, less than 0.1% of all donations given to U.S. charities over the past decade. And so, you know, I think it's important to identify and weed out the bad apples, but I don't think we should let people think, you know, this is the average charity or anything like that.
What about somebody who says, I'm just going to give my money to Red Cross because I know I can trust them, or that sort of attitude, as opposed to, you know, saying, I don't know if I can trust these other charities?
Yeah, I mean, like, that's not what I do, but I think it's a reasonable response. If you, you know, going with the big brand names where somebody's going to have looked into them instead of the people who are calling you up on your phone could be a reasonable reply. You know, GiveWell does really in-depth research on a few organizations to try and find top performers instead of trying to identify the people who are most likely to be frauds. And that's our approach, and that's how I give. But I think that there's a lot of different approaches you could take.
GiveWell also talks about impact. And there's a lot of people who are saying, you know, stop looking necessarily at all the details. Just look at what impact. Now, where are your metrics for that to decide what the actual impact of a charity is?
Yeah, it's really tough. And I mean, it's going to depend on what the charity is trying to do, right? And so a lot of the charities we recommend work in the developing world. And so, you know, our top charity gives out bed nets to prevent the spread of malaria in sub-Saharan Africa. And so we pay a lot of attention to like the actual like decrease in malaria rates where they give out their bed nets and whether people are using the bed nets and things like that. And so like what you'll see is that, you know, it takes a lot of resources to really pay attention to and track success of an organization over time, but that's what matters. You know, even if you spend relatively small portion of your income on actually trying to do good, you know, the real question is whether you're achieving the outcomes that you're trying to, not so much, you know, where exactly does the money go. Obviously, there are cases where it's just an outright fraud and you want to pay attention to those.
Well, GiveWell chooses sort of sparingly in some ways, smaller scale. I mean, because some of these charities are really – we're talking about some of the 50 is being pretty large scale, in fact.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so the charities that we tend to recommend tend to be smaller organizations that do one thing really, really well. And it's because, we're a fairly small team, and so it's easy for us to identify what they're doing and whether it's working. As you get to sort of the bigger, massive Red Cross type scale, like, I'm sure the Red Cross isn't a fraud, but on the other hand, it's really hard to know where a marginal dollar that you're going to donate to them is going to end up.
And let me get back to the two investigators here. You tried, and I'll go to you on this, Chris Hunley, if I could. You tried to look broadly, as Kendall said, I mean, throughout nonprofits and charities and so forth. What would be your estimate of how many really deserve to be investigated and maybe even have their tents pulled away?
Well, when we looked at the 6,000, they were identified by those that said in their 990s that they'd used outside fundraisers. As you probably know, a lot of charities are less than forthright on their 990s. There's a high percentage of them that say they raise funds and never say they have any fundraising costs. So just relying on what they've submitted in their 990, there's quite possibly...
It's not exactly what we would call transparency.
No. No, and the IRS apparently never catches them on it. But just going on what's on the 990, as I said, we rated these as the 50 worst based on how much they'd spent on the professional fundraisers. But there were several hundred that were spending large amounts on professional fundraisers over time and reliant on professional fundraisers.
And Kendall, you gave them 20 kind of benchmark questions, did you, in terms of disclosure and... In some instances, got no answers at all. They talked to my lawyer, but in other instances, nothing was forthcoming.
Yeah, we didn't. It depended on the organization. We didn't have a set framework. But any anomalies or things that Chris and I couldn't make sense of, what do you do with the money that you get? How effective are your programs? Send us some material. Show us what you do. Many of them were not willing to provide that kind of information, which I think should be an initial flag to any donor if a charity won't talk to you.
It also would be a flag if come at them like Mike Wallace with a camera and they don't want to talk to you or give you the bird. I'm going to give you a phone number to join us. In fact, we'd like to hear from you. And if you've had some experiences, I know that many of you have, you might want to bring them up in short narratives or just ask questions that are on your mind. We'd like to hear from you on this subject, talking about charities and about nonprofits and in many instances about scams that come under that tent. You can call us now at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also join the conversation on our website and our Facebook page or email us, forum@kqed.org. We're talking with Kendall Taggart and Chris Hunley, who together have been involved in this investigation. Kendall's with the Center for Investigative Reporter, and Chris is with the Tampa Bay Times as an investigative reporter. And Doug White is with us, author of The Nonprofit Challenge, Integrating Ethics into the Purpose and Promise of Our Nation's Charities. And here in studio, Alexander Berger, senior research analyst with GiveWell, a San Francisco-based charity evaluator. And we ought to mention, by the way, in addition to GiveWell, there's GuideStar, Charity Navigator, Give.org, the Better Business Bureau. There are places you can go to and should go to if you want to investigate. But the best thing to go to is the website of the person or people who supposedly are representing a charity and investigate as best you can. Onus does sometimes fall on you. We'll hear from you when we return. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Each year, charities such as Florida-based Kids Wish Network raise millions of dollars, in that case, in aid of dying children, supposedly. But according to a joint investigation by the Center for Investigative Reporting, the Tampa Bay Times, and CNN, Kids Wish Network gave less than 3 cents on the dollar to the cause, and the investigation identified the 50 worst charities in the country, which all devoted less than 4% of donations to direct cash aid. We're discussing the investigation, what should be done to crack down on bad charities, and how to make good decisions about where to send your charitable dollars. And Kendall Taggart of the Center for Investigative Reporting is with us, along with Chris Hunley from the Tampa Bay Times, and Doug White, who is an advisor to nonprofit organizations and philanthropists and teaches board governance, fundraising, and ethics at Columbia. And Alexander Berger here in studio, senior research analyst with GiveWell, a San Francisco-based charity evaluator. And I should mention, Alexander Berger, that... I'd said, you know, it's good to go to the website, but the website can often disguise things. I mean, an individual charity, they don't necessarily give the data. Some of them are actually pretty good-looking websites.
Right, that's right. I mean, you can go to any charity website and you'll see, you know, they might look good, they might not look bad, but that's going to tell you more about how much they spent on their website than how good the actual programs are. You know, if there's no website, that's kind of a warning flag in some ways, but it could also just be, you know, a small local mom and pop nonprofit that's doing good work. It's really hard to know from the website itself.
So again, what's the best thing that, from your perspective, Doug White, people can do to act as a prophylactic against what we're talking about here, which is in so many cases getting scammed or outright exploited?
Well, I think the first thing to do is to not give solely because someone has called and asked for money. I think you're right about not relying solely on the website, because a website can be a mask. But it is also the first step towards someone understanding what your charity is all about. So I think the website, although it's not the last stop, it's an important stop nonetheless.
I was thinking of first stop, and I may have misspoke myself, but thank you.
Well, I might have said the same thing earlier, and so I apologize for that. But it is important, but it's not the only thing one should do. One should look at their 990s, and they're very available on GuideStar. It's very simple to look up. It costs nothing, and it's a compilation of almost every charity, as far as I know, every charity in the United States. And so you can do that. Then you can go to places like Charity Navigator, that have the down and dirty numbers. I'm not a real fan of only that, for the same reason I'm not a fan of only the websites, because the 990s are old, and they're also very subjectively put together. Because in the last 10 to 15 years we've had such a discussion about how much people are being paid and the inefficiency of charities, which I think is a good conversation to have, don't get me wrong, but part of a result of that, is that organizations tend to skew their expenses more toward the programmatic side than perhaps they should, trying to get down those numbers of overhead and fundraising costs. But then, finally, you're looking at, this is unfortunate. See, yesterday I was talking to the people at the Center for Investigative Reporting, and I realized, in addition, Chris Huntley talked to me a long, long time ago, and I didn't realize until yesterday how much work they had to go through to unearth all of this information. It takes an enormous amount of work.
Absolutely right. That's why I honored them and gave them kudos initially, because I said, they really slogged through a lot here, an immense amount. Yeah.
So you're saying, okay, how can a person do this? And a person just can't do that. But a person can look at the 990s. They can go to Charity Navigator. And then I was looking up at the GiveWell site, too. And there's a lot of narrative there that doesn't come through when on the other sites. And quite frankly, for me, in addition to the numbers, which I think are important, it's the narrative that's important to me. And, you know, GiveWell doesn't do all million charities, I don't think, do you, Alexander? But, you know,
nope.
It's too bad you can't replicate yourself, Alexander. Huh?
I would love that, too.
But in terms of a model that does more than one charity, I think that's a great source to go to. You might not find your charity on there, but you look at what they've done. I'm looking at their site right now. Their review process involves extensive examination of public records and communications from the charity and visits, all things that I think a person ought to do. Now, is that person going to do that for $100 or $1,000 that he's pledged over the telephone? Probably not. But this is where I'm saying, you said it a moment ago, Michael, that donors, individuals have to take this responsibility on for themselves.
And let's take our calls and begin, Eduardo, with you. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I work for a nonprofit in San Francisco and have been on the board of many. And I have a big concern, because it sort of goes to the point you made earlier. Examination of things like corporate executive compensation was sort of promised as part of reform after the after the housing crash and the bank bailout.
I thought you were going to say after the. I thought you were going to say, excuse me, Eduardo, after the scandal with United Way.
Well, no. So the scandal with United Way brought that up in the nonprofit sector. But I'm pointing out that there's a double standard, in the sense that we expected a whole lot of scrutiny in the corporate sector that has not come forward, even under the sort of promises of the federal government. And this sort of what I've seen is sort of skewed, a tax on the structure and financing of nonprofits is really debilitating. We're small organizations. We are mission-driven. And we have to compete in the same markets as corporate organizations. So bringing sort of an unlevel playing field to the structure of nonprofits and highlighting abuses within that sector, I think, diminishes the value and the public trust that's very important if we're going to have any charitable organization.
And you say what to Eduardo Doug White?
Well, I think you're making a good – the caller's making a good point, although I don't feel like bringing or highlighting the abuses of charities does the charitable world harm. I actually argue the opposite. I think that – and I love charities. As I said earlier, I'm flying the flag for charities here, but it's a tough love, but it's a real love. We can't really consider ourselves – I'd like to consider ourselves the ethical sector. That's my – kind of like my mantra. But we can't consider ourselves to be a valid sector unless we are taking ourselves seriously. And we can't look the other way when these 50 charities, and there's so many others, are misbehaving.
And I should say here, if you go to our website, you can find links to the reports by Kendall and Chris and the list of these 50 worst charities. But I wonder if I could just follow this up with you, Doug White, for a moment on that sense of a double standard again. There's a guy you may know named Dan Pallotta, who is an activist and a fundraiser and who gave a TED Talk. And he says he's the only gay man or woman in the United States with triplets. That may be true. I don't know. But he says the emphasis shouldn't be on how little is spent by the charity. It should be on what they get done. And he's talking about big accomplishment and big goals. And he points out, for example, that we've had the same rate of poverty for 40 years here. We've had no cure for breast cancer, despite a lot of money going into breast cancer research. No cure for homelessness, despite a lot of money going into homelessness. Now, we're talking about massive scale charities and massive scale problems, to be sure, but no sight of solution. And maybe, therefore, we should hold them to a different standard.
Well, there certainly is a legitimate public policy question as to how much charity can do for the national issues that we face and how much government should do. But I'm familiar with Mr. Pallotta's work and celebrate it on one level and then despise it on another. The celebrating level is that, yes, we really ought to look at charities based on their outcomes and the effectiveness of their work. Where I find a difficult path, though, is following his a line of logic when it comes to measuring that productivity. For me, the holy grail with charitable work is finding out how they affect their communities. When I go into a boardroom and talk to board members, my first question is, what would happen to this community if this organization shut its doors this afternoon?
Is that a question you ask, Alexander Berger?
A lot of the organizations that we end up recommending work across a variety of different communities. They're not necessarily sort of small local nonprofits. They might work across countries even. And so the sort of community integration isn't the central question for us. We tend to ask questions about how good are they at the sort of particular program that they tend to run.
Well, let me just clarify. Ahead, when I say community, I meant how you define community. And it could be small. It could be national. It could be international. I use the word community as kind of your marketplace, if you will.
And let me bring some more callers on. And GS is our next caller. Good morning. Welcome to Forum.
Thank you very much. I'll give a positive side of things here. I missed the very beginning. Anyway, I subscribe, or I should say donate, to an organization called Children International. Now, I haven't checked out the $9.99 and all of that, but basically people, young people especially, in poverty, families with children living in dire poverty, in a few different countries in South America, it's amazing how far a little bit can go. I've been donating only $25 a month, and the little guy I'm helping, Anthony, has a new pair of shoes, you know, at 1 month. And then next month he's got a special shirt he likes or a backpack or something. And it's amazing what a transformation happens. They stop feeling desperately, hopelessly poor. They start feeling like, oh, God, my feet don't hurt when I go to school. And then they feel better about going to school. And it just kind of goes on from there. It starts with the young kids, making sure that they're healthy. Then you get the children excited about learning. And later on, you just, you know, they're heading on towards success. And some of them come back around and, you know, pitch back in and help the little kids get even better. So,
GS, forgive me. You're giving a good plug and pitch for them. Do we know anything about Children International? Nobody does. Well, what about when you get a personal letter? Chris or Kendall, because that's, I think, what you mentioned first, GS.
Yes.
I mean, should that make a difference? You know, for example, I gave some money a while back to help kids with cleft palates and got a letter from the kid, and, you know, it was a simple form of surgery, and they did the job, and it was clear that that succeeded in doing what I wanted it to do. But at the same time, maybe I should have investigated more.
I mean, I think that is the point that Doug's bringing up, is doing your research is always helpful, that no matter how appealing the pitch, it may not be going where you think it is. Regulators also have a role in helping donors make that decision, though, and I think that there's more work that could be done, as Doug said, at the state level to help weed out the bad actors than what we have now.
Well, let me thank GS for the call. Chandra writes, very informative show. Could you please discuss donations in supermarkets, the extra $1, $2, $3 that go to charities? Do supermarkets get a cut on the charities they promote at the checkout counter? Does the entire money go to the charities? I was told recently about Safeway saying you want to donate, and the response to the person who told me the story was, no, I don't know if this charity is for real, and how am I, until I investigated, it sounded, felt like Scrooge or a cheapskate, you know. But at the same time, the person at the cash register, they may have been drinking the Kool-Aid. They said, no, I know 100% is going to the charity. Maybe it is. You know, it's a person's quick, almost Pavlovian response to say, okay, a dollar more, you know, why not? Now, another comment. Since Red Cross was mentioned, it is interesting to note that the Red Cross gets only 3 or 4 stars on the Charity Navigator page. Every time there's a disaster, I can guarantee that a bevy of fundraisers will be downtown waiting to ambush people into making a donation. It's never clear whether the victims of the current disaster actually benefit. And a listener named Bailey says, community foundations are a wonderful resource for responsible and effective charitable giving. They generally have incredible breadth and depth of knowledge about the local nonprofit community and can be trusted to perform at a high level of due diligence in ensuring the funds they steward go to support worthy organizations with demonstrable impact. And a listener asks, how should the public act with so-called charities that are collecting money outside grocery stores? Now, let's get back to Safeway and grocery stores, both in and out. Any thoughts on that for us from any of you?
You know,
Alexander Berger?
Yeah, one of the things I would say about this is that, you know, I would repeat what Doug said, which is that in general, I think, you know, when you're giving to charity, it should be a sort of intentional decision where you're going out and finding the organizations that you want to support instead of giving responsibly. And I think it can feel a little Scrooge-like, but once you sort of make that decision, like, no, you know, maybe at the end of the year or every month or whenever you feel like it, you're going to make that decision about how you want to spend your charitable dollars. I think it's much easier to become more strategic and thoughtful about how you're going to spend it when you sort of set the time, set the budget, instead of just sort of giving, you know, a dollar here, a dollar there in response. And at the end of the year, you don't really know where your money went.
Decide where you want to put your money.
Yeah.
Plain and simple. Chris Hunley, let me go back to you with a question from a listener named David who says, other than exposing these cheats, what can be done legislatively? Has there been legislation targeting this, and what's the history of it?
Well, as we said, every state is responsible for regulating these. The IRS seldom comes down on these cases. The FTC occasionally takes nationwide actions. But some states have implemented some interesting ways to get to this issue. Oregon, for instance, has a, if you're on their do not call list in Oregon, charities are, and their solicitors are not allowed to call you. That's not the case, I know, in Florida, and I believe it's not the case in California either. Charities and their telemarketers are exempt from those do not call restrictions. The state of Iowa has an interesting way to attack this. They don't even require charities to register with their state, but they do require the fundraisers to register. And when adult children complain that their parents who are suffering from Alzheimer's get in touch with the AG's office and say that their parents have been victimized by some of these telemarketers, the Iowa AG's office asks if the parent's phone number can be rerouted to their office. And they've trained one of the assistants there as she works. When that phone rings, she answers. She takes the call and she asks a few very strategic questions that every citizen should be asking. Where are you calling from? Are you the charity or are you a paid telemarketer? And how much of my money goes to the actual charity? And the Iowa AG's office couldn't remember the last time they didn't fail to find fraud on one of those recorded calls.
Well, what you just alluded to is, again, a scandalous and terrible problem of older people with Alzheimer's or dementia being bilked out of money when they're right. home and they're lonely and they get a call or whatever it is, and they're able to give information and make a donation. We asked, by the way, on Facebook, what characteristics do you look for in the charities you donate to? Listener writes, overheads and how much of my money actually goes to the cause I'm donating. Another listener says, also controversy affects my decisions. Komen, that's the Susan G. Komen Foundation, is a no-no now, even though I'm a breast cancer survivor, or maybe because of it. Let me get another caller on here, and that's Luke. Good morning.
Good morning. Fantastic program. I'd just like to add that no organization, whether for-profit or non-profit, is perfect, and also that philanthropy is really a lifelong skill. You get better at it as you do it, and you shouldn't wait for the perfect opportunity, because there is no perfect organization, and you should give and give generously, whether you have $5 and $5 million or $5 million, and that's the best way to get involved and use some of the great advice that you've given on this program.
Thank you, Luke. Good to hear from you. We'll hear from another caller, and that's Lorraine. Hi, Lorraine.
Hi, I'm Lorraine Woodruff-Long. I'm executive director of a local nonprofit here in San Francisco, the San Francisco PAL, and we are not part of a state association that gets very poor Guide Star ratings and does very aggressive telemarketing in San Francisco. And probably not a week goes by that somebody doesn't tell me, oh, I got a phone call, or I gave because your people were bugging us. And this is money that is not going to us. We are not a member. We receive none of it. And, in fact, we make quite a big deal about we do not make phone calls for individual giving. As, as a mid-sized organization, our choice is, do we spend resources going after these individuals in a litigious way, or do we spend our resources really building our brand? And, of course, we're focusing on the latter. And so we've really had a challenge with that. It's been going on for about 20 years. And we just really have to market that the San Francisco PAL does not do telemarketing. I love the guidance that's being given here. I think we're going to really, we will definitely link to it and post to it, because we're really losing money because people think they're giving to us, and nothing's coming to us through this effort.
So you have to spend more resources on marketing to let people know.
We're within the guidelines being recommended here, and we focus our money on resources. But yeah, you do have to spend some on education.
Well, Lorraine, thank you for the call. And again, on Facebook, we asked, what characteristics do you look for in the charities you donate to? Brian writes, first off, I call the organization and ask for the CEO's salary. I ask about efficacy in terms of what percentage of my dollar goes to the cause. I once had a small San Francisco-based charity that buys redwood groves solicit money from me, so I called and asked about the CEO's salary. It was $350,000, so you can properly guess that they received no money from me. On the other hand, here's Stacy, who says, in the interest of not throwing out the baby with the bathwater, on an earlier broadcast, you had a guest that I believe was associated with breast cancer events, and he discussed cost, compensation of fundraising, and how sometimes higher costs do result in higher net donations, and that it is worth it to have competent CEOs, et cetera, and pay high salaries, presumably. Also, I would like to hear more about the fundraising companies themselves that are charging or being given these huge accounts. Is there no standard or way of regulating them? Why do they feel entitled to such a large percentage of revenues? Are there companies that do the same work for less? Kendall, we'll go to you.
Sure. One of the companies that we've written about, well, I should say as background, there were a couple of Supreme Court cases that have made it so that states cannot draw a stark line in the sand and say that regulators or that fundraisers can only get 30%, 70%, whatever it is. So their hands are somewhat tied about that part of it. There's certainly firms that charge more and charge less. Overall, telemarketing is a very expensive way to raise money. One of the companies that we looked at that was the subject of a multi-state action, 38 states got together, was called Community Support, Inc. And they were charging 90 cents, 80 cents in most of their contracts for many of the charities on our list. So in that sense, it's certainly a small world, and the fundraisers themselves are worth getting to know.
One more email from Greg, who writes, for anyone who wants to move from reporting to advocacy for reform, here's my suggestion. Contact the Commission on Uniform State Laws, an organization composed of the 50 state legislatures. It looks at issues like the charity problem you're discussing, studies the problem, consults experts, examines the laws in states that have good laws, and develops a proposed uniform state law, which many legislatures then adopt. The uniform law is sometimes better than any of the existing state laws, such as including a mechanism for interstate cooperation. Let me go to more of your calls, and we'll go next to Joshua. Good morning.
Yeah, my question is just having to do with how do you solve the problem. And what I really don't understand is everyone keeps talking about government solutions and regulation and this and that. Why don't the good guys just get together and say, we're going to put this label on our product. This label is going to say exactly what we spend, what the percentage is, goes to the people that need the product, and when we make if we use telemarketers, they're going to give that same exact information. If we don't use telemarketers, we're going to still give out the same exact label, and the bad guys can lose on that front, because it's collectively you get together and don't look for a government solution and just solve your own problem.
Yeah, truth in labeling, like organic food or something along those lines. Doug White, seem like a solution to you?
Well, I've always felt that the charitable community in general ought to be the leader in this kind of an effort. I agree with the caller on that point. But I'm also reminded, I think Chris or Taggart just mentioned a minute ago about the Supreme Court case. The most recent one was in 2003, the Madigan case, the fourth of its kind. And yes, the problem there was twofold. One is we didn't get any clear guidance about the 70-30 or whatever, and I guess that's okay. What really bothers me, though, is the number of charities that lined up on behalf of the telemarketers in their amicus brief. So to your caller's point, I believe that we really need to do a lot more work to investigate ourselves, to become true to ourselves, and say, okay, this is the way charity ought to be. And that, I think, would be a very good way, or at least a very good step toward allowing the public to have better information about what charities to support.
And let me thank Joshua for the call and go right to another call. Kim, thank you for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Hi, Michael. I teach strategic philanthropy at Haas, and I ran the second largest donor advised fund in the country for about a decade. So I'm a little bit familiar with these issues. And I really want to commend the reporters from Tampa Bay, because as we were designing our due diligence practice for our grants, and we processed about 50,000 grants a year, our biggest frustration were two things. One was the
by the way, just for the record, excuse me, Kim, not just from Tampa Bay, also from Center for Investigative Reporting and CNN.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Our two frustrations were, one, exactly what you've identified, the fact that the states aren't coordinated in terms of either their regulation or the any kind of database that allowed us to tap into it to understand what actions they had taken on charities. And the second thing was the separation of church and state. Because of the separation of church and state, which we certainly all believe in, it makes it very easy to conduct fraud around houses of worship. So those are the two areas of frustration. However, I did want to comment on two things. One is, I think there's a distinction between identifying fraud and finding the best in class. And I think you're blending them a little bit in this discussion. The work that the investigators did was identifying the equivalent of the Madoffs in investment opportunities. And finding the best investment you can make is the kind of work that GiveWell does. So there is a huge difference between sort of eliminating the fraud and identifying best in class. And you can give to charities that aren't necessarily the very best in their class, but they're in your community, or you know somebody who volunteers for it. And that's not a bad donation. It's like making an investment in a stock that's not necessarily the best performing in its sector. The second point I wanted to make is I get very nervous when we promote the distinction or the metric that the percentage of an operating budget that's spent on fundraising or administration should be low and the percent on programs should be high. Because it's the equivalent of saying to a company, you cannot invest in computer systems and you cannot invest in talent. And I do think we should monitor executive compensation. But if you want the brightest and talented people, they need to be compensated fairly. And if you want to deliver water after a natural disaster, you need to have computer systems and infrastructure to get it there inexpensively.
Now, Kim, I think the second argument is a fair one, and it has been sort of in the warp, at least, of this conversation. But I'd like to hear some response from our panelists about the idea that, well, from the reporters, really, that there's kind of maybe a conflation here of fraud with organizations that are legitimate.
I think for a lot of readers after our series ran, which was called the America's Worst Charities and named the 50 Bad Charities, wrote in asking for the 50 best. And I think the work that GiveWell's doing to try and identify really top-performing charities goes a long way to do that. But as we've said to many of our readers, they're not the same process. The numbers that you need to look at, the information you need to get to identify bad actors and the information you might need to identify good actors, like the caller said, are certainly not the same thing.
Well, again, you can get the 50 worst that came out of this study by simply going to our website, kqed.org/forum. And you can also, of course, continue this discussion by going to our website or our Facebook page. And I want to extend thanks to all who participated on the panel this morning. Also, congratulations, Kendall Taggart and Chris Hunley, to both of you for yo-person work now. We're in a non-sexist world. Thanks to Doug White for being with us. Thanks, Alexander Berger, Senior Research Analyst with GiveWell. And again, we want to mention those organizations like GiveWell that are out there for you simply to check with: GuideStar, Charity Navigator, Give.org, and look at your Better Business Bureau as well as the websites. I appreciate you, our listeners, being with us. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. Thomas Friedman from the New York Times, famed columnist and Pulitzer Prize, multiple Pulitzer Prize winner, will join us in the hour ahead. Hope you will be with us as well. I want to extend thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai. Our engineer today is Howard Gelman. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.